read a magazine article this week that was written by a man whose wife had a brain aneurysm in 2013. She's alive now, but in this essay, her husband reflected on the scary, chaotic days, many of them, that followed that awful thing that happened in her brain. As a helicopter airlifted her from the tennis court to a hospital, as her family held vigil at her bedside, in the weeks they thought they were going to lose her, and then as she came slowly back to herself over many months, one thing, one idea, one realization came clearly into this husband's focus, he said. Relinquishment was the word that came to him. The knowledge that whatever happened to his wife, the internal work he had to do was to be willing to let her go, to hold on to her a little less tightly. I realized that I was addressing the question of losing Susan from the wrong perspective, he said. She wasn't mine to lose. She was never mine to own. It was a crazy, disordered, unimaginably chaotic time for him. It felt like everything in his life might be falling apart. And as that happened, one thing became clear to him, that he didn't own this person he loved more than anything else, that he held her in trust for God, who had put her graciously, generously into his hands, his life, for just a while. You know, stressful, difficult times can be enormously clarifying. Times of grief, deep grief, can feel like this too. There's a sharpness about them, those moments. And if we are paying attention and can calm our frantic minds, often something emerges, a truth, a realization that rises above everything else, the one thing we had to know, the one thing that matters. In the words that Sarah read from the Gospel of John this morning, I think we're seeing that kind of crystallizing moment in the life of Jesus. We read those words often in isolation from their context, so it's hard to see this at first. And we hear them from where we stand now, 2,000 years later, so it's even harder for us to capture the feel of that moment. But stand back a little bit with me this morning. This is John's story of the last night of Jesus' life. Jesus and his best friends were sharing their last evening and meal together. Jesus knew that he was one day away from his own death, but no one else in the room had put the pieces together clearly enough to see it. Chaos was about to erupt. Soldiers, a trial, a cross, a betrayal by one of his closest friends. This is the kind of drama that movies are made from. And Jesus must have felt very alone, very sad, probably very anxious. He had just a tiny bit of time left to create a lasting impression with these friends that he loved, people who had to understand him if anything he had spent his life working for was going to survive. One thing. Of all the things he had talked about, tried to teach and show them over 3 years, one thing rose up in Jesus' mind that night. One clear, sharp, simple message. And he gave it to them in two ways. First, he took off his outer robe, the piece of clothing that gave him dignity and warmth. He He knelt down so that he was underneath them. And then he washed their feet as if he was their servant, as if it was his work, as if he was that person you wouldn't even bother to look at directly because it was just their job to do that kind of messy, meaningless task. And then he said it to them with words. He said, "I'm giving you a new commandment. Love one another just as I have loved you, like I just showed you. Love one another. This is what it will look like to follow me. This is how, when other people watch you, they will know that you belong to me." So here's the thing that captures me about those verses this morning. It's Jesus saying, "Here's a new commandment." So what was new about this? Was this a commandment a surprise to his disciples? Hadn't they heard him say already, "Love God, love your neighbor," when someone asked him about the two most important commandments? What did Jesus think was new here? And I'm thinking that maybe what Jesus was saying to those disciples was, "Here's what I see now is the one thing. Of all the things I've said to you, all the things that have seemed important, here's the one thing I know at this moment matters more than anything else. If you forget everything else, remember this. One thing. Love one another. This is what I know with absolute clarity." Today's our last day in this series of summer sermons about people who have walked on paths parallel to Jesus, winners of the Nobel Peace Prize. Most of the people that we have talked about have received the prize recently: Malala Yousafzai, Nelson Mandela, Wangari Maathai, Jimmy Carter, Muhammad Yunus, the Dalai Lama. But today I've chosen someone who's sort of a historical figure, someone who won the Peace Prize in 1952, Albert Schweitzer. His name is not unfamiliar, but I wonder if you feel, as I did, that no matter how many times you've heard his name, you're really not quite sure what Albert Schweitzer did or who he was. So here's the short course. Schweitzer was French, and he was born in 1875. He spent most of his adult life and his work in a city called Lambaran in Gabon, which is a country on the west coast of Africa, just south of Sierra Leone. Schweitzer had many, many talents. He was a musician, a musical prodigy, really. He began to play the organ when he was 8, when his feet could barely reach the pedals. A famous organist was so impressed with Schweitzer's talents when he was a child that he taught him for no charge. And Schweitzer became quite a well-known organist himself. And then he went on to write the authoritative 2-volume book on the compositions of Johann Sebastian Bach. When he was 18, Schweitzer entered the University of Strasbourg in Austria to study theology and philosophy and musical theory. And he completed a PhD, and he wrote a bunch of books, including one called The Quest for the Historical Jesus, which established him as a very important theologian. When I was in seminary not that many years ago, we studied Schweitzer's book because it began a movement in Christian theology that is still having important impact. But even that was not enough for him. Schweitzer went back to school, medical school, and he became a physician, a surgeon, because what he really felt himself called to do was to be a missionary and to serve people in Africa where there were few trained doctors. He said, I wanted to be a doctor so that I could work without having to talk. For years, I had been giving myself out in words. This work wasn't just talking about the religion of love, it was actually putting it into practice. In Lambaran, he built a hospital, and eventually, he built 70 buildings with 350 beds and a place that housed 200 people who had leprosy. And he actually built the buildings with his own hands. He kept going with other things, too. While he was in Africa, he wrote and published a 2-volume book called The Philosophy of Civilization, which was his masterwork in ethics. He lectured all over the world. He received honorary doctorate degrees. Albert Schweitzer was a remarkably accomplished man. He had gifts and talents in many areas that most of us don't have in one. But there was one thing, just one big idea, that summed up for Albert Schweitzer what was important in his life, and life in general, he thought. And he called it reverence for life. It became his philosophy. This reverence for life guided everything he did, and he described it very simply. He said, "It is good to help life grow. It is bad to damage or to destroy life. Every living thing has a desire to live," he believed. "And in that common desire, we are brothers and sisters to every living thing, human, plant, animal. We owe to all of them the same care and respect that we want for ourselves." For him, for Schweitzer, this was such a profound insight that it rose to the significance of a religion. It was his religion. This was Schweitzer's one thing. Of all the things that he could do and did, of all the things that had brought him fame and satisfaction and recognition, here was the one thing that mattered most to him, that distilled every other piece of work, every goal to its essential purpose. For him, a reverence of life, all life. Do you remember that story from the Gospels when Jesus goes to the home of two sisters for dinner and they have a fight? Martha is running around getting dinner ready, taking care of all the details, making sure that everything is just right. And her sister Mary is distracted by Jesus' presence. And so she just sits down and listens to him talk. She sits at his feet and she listens for a long time, and she forgets completely about helping her sister. And at the moment that Martha is most flustered and frustrated, she complains to Jesus. "Geez," she says, "look at this. There are a million things to do here, and my sister is not helping at all." And how does Jesus answer? He says, "Here's how it looks to me, Martha. You are worried about many things. You're distracted and pulled in many directions. You've lost sight of what really matters. Just one thing. One thing." Is there one thing that makes sense of your life? Something that guides your thinking and your actions? Some piece of wisdom that focuses your attention when life gets chaotic and you get pulled in many different directions? Is there one idea, one rule of life that captures your best hope for yourself? A word that calls you back to what is most important? One thing. Just one thing. Amen.